Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about.
This episode of Garden DC, we're talking to Jan Kirsch, sculptor and landscape designer. She's lived on the Eastern Shore of Maryland for 35 years. And welcome to the podcast, Jan.
Thanks, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And I've been a longtime admirer of your sculptures and your designs. So we want to dive into both those topics. But first, let me know what's going on in your world right now during COVID. Are you busier than ever? Are you looking for work? How is it going for you?
I am thoroughly engaged. I actually haven't missed a beat. When COVID arrived in March, being deemed essential was a blessing. And I haven't looked back. I'm busy, and really enjoying the collaboration with so many very interesting clients over here on the shore.
That's great. I am hearing similar things from other designers that this is their busiest year almost ever.
I can't say that because I've been in business for a long, long time, but it is. The work is phenomenal. I'm working with folks who are so enjoying their gardens. I mean, thoroughly enjoying being on the shore, and they're just so much psychic pleasure from being out of doors. And it's been a terrific year. Absolutely.
Good. And like many of us, you have multiple titles that you wear. Mm-hmm. So like writer, speaker, and also landscape designer and sculptor. How do you divide your time between those two main titles, sculptor and landscape designer?
It varies and has varied over the years. I concentrate on the landscape design for obvious reasons in, spring, summer, and fall. More than the sculpture, I do try and get into the studio frequently in my busy landscape design season, but the winter does give me an opportunity to sculpt more. If I am preparing for a show, and I've been lucky enough to do that a handful of times, especially a solo show, if I'm preparing for a solo show, I don't think I sleep. I think I just work all the time at both of them and just, race back and forth. I have a studio and an office right at my house. So I just like jump out of bed and hit the ground running and doing both basically when the time is necessary.
It's great that you can work from home. And when you're preparing for a show, and I know that there's still been some happening during these COVID times. What goes into that? Do you create new works for every show, or is it just a labeling type thing?
That's varied also, though. I would say during COVID, my most recent show was at the Zenith Gallery down in D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. And that show was work that was already in existence. When I did the show at the Maryland Hall for the Creative Arts in Annapolis a couple years ago, I built loads of new work. I was like on fire because I had to fill and wanted to fill a big gallery space with even like a little additional room. It was an awesome space in a really cool facility. And I... three-dimensional art takes up room, but you need lots of it. And that was a big push, but fun and certainly worthwhile.
And can you describe for our listeners your style of sculptures?
My sculpture, it's been described as sensual, whimsical. I do fruit and vegetable sculpture. I try to find the essence of a form, and I use real fruits and vegetables as models frequently, and then there's a point where the piece kind of takes on its own character. And I might, you know, like I remember one time going to the local farmer's market and buying the most magnificent onion. And I raced home and started sculpting it. It was fabulous. But there was a point where I was far enough along on the piece that I took the onion in the kitchen and, you know, sauteed it. It was, you know, it sort of served its purpose to get me going. And then I jump forward, and that's when the pieces really take on their, like, you know, kind of personality. And they're, you know, each piece has plenty of that.
And I think the most striking thing about your sculptures is their size and how they might be used in the landscape. So if listeners are picturing a peach that looks just like a peach, think of it more as like a peach on steroids.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I do love the big pieces, and that happens. Are you ready for the elevator pitch, Kathy?
Totally.
Okay. So this is my quick explanation is that I make my pieces in an oil-based clay, and I sculpt them at a reasonable size. It's manageable, and I can move them around. But once the piece is done, I have a mold made, and I do a one-off casting of each piece in plaster. And then I worked the plaster piece just to death until it's like absolutely as perfect as I can get it. And I love the texture and the feel of it. And at that point, I have my work scanned and they make a 3D model. So I'm, you know, I'm sort of have one foot in the 16th century, and then the other one is firmly planted in the 21st century. That technology helps me take that 3D model, and I can enlarge a piece to virtually any size that I want. So it really opens the door wide. I have, in fact, I have a 37-inch aubergine, a big purple eggplant that's sitting on Main Street in Ellicott City. And the model for that piece was only about 12 inches tall. So that's, you know, that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating. And I'm going to ask the hard question next, Jan, which is, why fruits and vegetables? What drew you to that subject matter?
Yeah, you're not the first. I guess it's because I love to cook. I love to eat. I like to grow vegetables. I remember being a student 150 years ago in college and studying photography and asking my professor if it was okay if I, you know, did some program or, you know, class about, I think I was told to go off and do some still life work. And I just like found the produce aisle in the grocery store totally inspiring and fabulous, and went to the man who managed the produce department and asked if I could take pictures. And I think that's sort of what got me going. It's just, you know, it's just like a love of the essential shapes and forms of what nature produces. Always have found them fascinating. So, and then it has just grown from there, on and on. And I'm not ready to move on to the next theme yet. I still think there are others. There are others in my future that I haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah, and I would think that the colors are so vibrant in your work. Who are your influences?
Well, the fruit itself, I think. But there, I guess, like pop artists, you know, back in the day when I was, I'm gonna like, I don't want to tell you how old I am, but the, you know, it's sort of like Andy Warhol-ish, and that, you know, there's an awful lot of work that was done back in the 60s and 70s that I think was influential. And I just, you know, I'm like surrounded by nature. So it's not as much influenced by a particular artist as it is being thrust into like the, you know, the center of crazy color all season long as I'm designing and enjoying gardens. I just, you know, it's like, how could you not notice purple, red, orange, and yellow? Hard to miss.
Yeah, and just scrolling through Instagram these days, you can see everybody's peppers that, you know, they've discovered. Even if you don't like to eat hot peppers, they sure make a great photography subject.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I have, yeah, if you look at my website where my sculpture portfolio lives, I'm sort of top heavy on peppers because they're fabulous. No question. They're just, you know, really just the shapes and forms and colors are awesome. And, I think, Weston's photographs of the green pepper, that I think was influential in the early days. But the, you know, I can't pin the color on any specific artist. I think it's just because my eyes are open.
See, I was thinking you were going to say Magritte, who is one of my favorite artists, for the green apples.
Okay. But, well, yeah. No. You can pretend. And I'm always open to suggestions. I'm very collaborative. I just had a conversation with someone who saw my pineapple at a local show in Easton. And she was just in love with the pineapple. And we just, you know, we had a conversation about like, how big is it and where will it fit? And is it going to sit on a base? And it was, it's like this. And you know, she wasn't sure what she was going to do with the piece. She just knew that she loved it. And there is like, we just began today this collaborative process of, is it going to work for her? Where is it going to work? How is it going to be set? What size is the base? You know, it's like, yeah, it's really lovely give and take when a patron reaches out to me.
That's interesting to hear about the client relationship in art, because you always think of the solitary artist creating things because that's within them. But the real world practicality, obviously, is that you're working directly with people who will be incorporating your art into their household or landscapes.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think that the, and you know this because you talk to garden designers all the time, the collaborative portion of building a garden for someone is just, in my, you know, humble opinion, a really important facet. You know, you're not designing a garden, you know, for you. You're designing a garden for someone else. And that's why the conversation and the collaborative effort, you know, is just like wildly important. And I love that part. I thrive on it. It's just, you know, picking someone's brain and finding out what makes them tick and, why does their heart sing at, you know, a particular color or type of plant, or what's going to draw them out of their house into the garden. And it might be a piece of my sculpture that does that, but it also might be, a particular tree in bloom, or a sweep of some kind of flower, or just, you know, it's like chatter and chatter and more chatter all about art and form and shape and color. It's it's like what makes going to work a pleasure for me.
And that obviously has a lot of crossover with your design work and working with clients there. And let's pivot to talk about your design side a little bit. So I would say maybe share a little bit about your style of garden design and your philosophy.
That's a big open. How, do you have like an extra hour and a half?
Sure.
It's like, oh boy, I've been a garden designer for, dare I say, 37 years. So it's, I've been at it for a long time. And I think there's not like one style, though I do hear from people in my community, you know, real estate agents, you know, and house builders and architects, I mean, people who have the occasion to, you know, poke around in other people's gardens, that they can see or recognize some quality that's somewhat universal in my work. And it's a sense of just like paying attention to scale. I think the other thing that I think about is how it feels to move through a garden. I'm really conscious of not like standing in one place and just having a view. It's more like movement and, you know, how are you going to walk from here to there to here to there? That I think has, you know, that's like influenced my style. I certainly have been influenced by the native landscape here on the Eastern Shore. So I think my gardens do, for the most part, have a certain feeling of belonging to the environment. And the quality of the plants and the light affect my design. And I also am super conscious of the architecture. And I want the garden to be complementary to the house and not sort of overwhelm it and not compete. I think architects kind of enjoy working, you know, collaboratively with me because I'm, you know, it's like, okay, you can go first. And, you know, I know that the house is really setting the tone and my job is to, you know, improve the house by having a garden that complements it. That I think that helps. And I'm super lucky because I do design a good majority of my projects are riverfront, waterfront, Eastern Shore properties. And so it's like I've got great bones and they're already pretty. I just make them better. How's that?
Perfect. Yeah. And you're so lucky to be in the area you are for those beautiful vistas that you can borrow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the gardens, Kathy, don't, I try really hard to, like, if someone has, you know, they're lucky enough to have a beautiful western sunset view, or the, you know, some of my clients have this like southern point, you know, like poking out into one of our creeks or rivers. It's, you know, there's just like so much natural drama already that sometimes the garden doesn't, you know, you don't want to compete. It's like, who's going to fight with the sunset? I don't think so. So, you know, my gardens in that case may need to be kind of subtle and just sort of playing second fiddle, but we're supporting cast. And that, you know, I definitely pay attention to that as well. And I want my gardens to always kind of tell the story of which season we're in. Like if someone were dropped into one of my gardens from outer space and they're like in one of my clients' houses and they're looking out the window, I want them to know that we're in the height of summer, or that we're in the dead of winter, or that, oh boy, here we go, we're in those very early days of spring. You should be able to look at the garden and pinpoint almost to the week where we are in the calendar.
I like that seasonality and sensibility that your gardens are almost, you know, echoing or playing second fiddle, as you say, to nature.
For sure. And you don't, I guess I, you know, I'm not criticizing, but there are so many gardens, it seems that they're like super heavy with evergreens. And, you know, there's a, you can look at the garden in February and then you look at the same garden in August, you look at the same garden in June, and it's like, you can't tell because there's just, you know, they're too much the same. But I, yeah, no, mine have that, you know that it's November when you're looking at a, one of the gardens I've designed, just because, you know, that's how a November garden looks. It's sort of like borrowing from nature. You're absolutely right.
I think you actually finally solved a mystery for me, why I don't love formal boxwood gardens. I think you actually finally explained to me why, because you can always look out on them, you know, every single day of the year, it's the same garden.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, boxwood are great. I do use them. I love the fact that the deer don't eat them. that's a good thing. And the Eastern Shore, I mean, we've got a lot of really beautiful historic homes. And boy, oh boy, if you didn't use boxwood over here, it's like, you know, it doesn't fit. But there are other things to be incorporate. You know, the boxwood are just a player for me. They're not the big, you know, they're not the main menu. That it's, you know, there's more to it.
Do you have favorite plant families or maybe even specific plants? I'm thinking of specific grasses maybe that you like to use.
Yeah, I like muley grass a lot, the Muhlenbergia. I used to use more of the miscanthus, but I've, you know, I still occasionally will use them, but not as many. Because the panicum, the switchgrass, are so present here on the shore, I think panicum may be a real favorite of mine. I love spirobolus. I use a ton of sedges. There are a lot of grasses. I have one project in particular. It's one of my clients who's a DC resident, in fact, who has a second house over here. And, when we started working together back in 2011, I think it was, it was like going through the interview process and just trying to, you know, figure out what makes him tick and what, you know, what's he looking for. He basically said, I am a fan of grasses, and the more grasses you use, the better. And we have, and it's been awesome. It just, you know, and it looks, his garden really looks like it belongs on the Miles River. You know, it's just like, it makes sense. I have some exotics too, but there are a lot of native grasses and, some of them evergreen, some of them not. I think in terms of plant families, I guess grasses are a real favorite, but I have a really wide array of plants that I incorporate. And, you know, the fun for me is to take the knowledge I have about so many plants and hone my list. You know, like really refine it so that there's a lot of textural play going on between the plants. I'm definitely a texture freak. I love color, but the gardens look cool because there's so much textural difference and interest. I can't pin. It's sort of like, who influenced my color? I don't think there's an answer. And do I, it's like asking someone with five kids, who's their favorite? I don't have one, Kathy. Sorry. the hardest part for me is maybe limiting the list. I want to do a lot of repetition in the garden. So I just like, really work hard at making that plant list happen for a client's garden. You know, it's like all about form and shape and texture. And then I start plugging in the plants. It's not the other way around. I'm like painting a picture. And once I get the bones of the picture done, then I start looking seriously at like, okay, if I need somebody who's spiky or, you know, rounded or wispy or, you know, whatever the form is that I'm looking for. It's like, let me figure that out first. And then the plants, the specifics of the plants show up. Does that make sense? That makes sense to you?
Yeah. And it is, makes sense. And it's very interesting from a home gardener point of view, where you're very plant centric and you're going to the garden center or a plant sale and you pick out a bunch of plants and then you go home and you say, where do these fit? Because you bought them with no plan in mind, but you just fell in love with the plants.
Yes. Oh yeah. No, I can't. I mean, I can do the same thing. I mean, my own garden is clearly a collector's garden, but I still, I'm still driven by like plant combinations and, just, you know, I do quite a few, what I call, hedgerows or privacy borders. I mean, you know, you guys over there on the western side of the bay have the same issues with folks who want to have a sense of enclosure. So I'm called upon to build, you know, what I refer to as my hedgerows as a privacy border between two property owners. And those privacy borders or those hedgerows are like, they can be, you know, 300-500 feet in length. I mean, this is a good stretch. And I look at that as a challenging kind of painterly garden solution. So it's a matter of looking at the space and solving problems, you know, and making it feel enclosed and private. But all the while, it's like you're painting with plants. It's like a different way of looking at it. And but I totally understand and support your, sort of plant addiction and habit, because I'm there too. I won't deny that I often see something and I go, oh, I just love this plant. I walk around my clients' gardens and I sometimes covet things that I've done for them, but I can't like bring every single thing home that I've ever planted for everyone and put it in my garden. That would be silly. I would have no room to walk. It would be too jammed. I only have like just under 2 acres, and it's, you got to have some breathing room in a garden too. That's also equally important, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I need to adopt some of these design sensibilities because, yeah, I don't have any breathing room on my little corner garden here.
All right. Well, I'll come see you. I'll come see you when the weather's right and we're traveling again. And yes, I'll wave my arms around. I'll be happy to give you a consultation.
Well, thank you. And that does bring up, and you had referred to the client you've been working for years. What is your client process? Do you meet with them first and then mutually decide to work together, or how do you usually work it?
Someone calls me, or I've been recommended to them, you know, or they find me on the web, or, you know, there are all kinds of ways of, you know, the real estate agent that sold them the house might recommend me, or the builder who's doing some renovations, or the architect that's drawing for them, and just any number of ways, or maybe a neighbor. Word of mouth is pretty strong around here. I do a little bit of advertising, but there's a lot of chatter in our community. I think that's how I think many of my clients have found me. Though I must say that the internet is also like a great source of client. New people finding my work. Once there is that initial phone call and the project sounds interesting, and we just like dance around each other and talk and make sure it feels comfortable, then I will make a site visit. It's not really important for them to come to my office. It's way more important for me to go and visit them in their home. You know, this is when COVID's done, I'll be happy again when I can run in and out of people's houses at whim and just look out their windows and make sure I catch their views. But we do have a good, hour plus, it seems to run into hour and a half, 2 hours, that first visit when we walk the site and I take volumes of notes, and we're just sort of scoping out what the wish list is all about and what the practical needs are, and, you know, do they want a swimming pool, and do they want a fire pit, and, you know, do we need a shade structure? They're just, you know, any number of drivers. And very often a client will ask me for a master plan or like a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. It depends on the size of the property and, you know, how eager they are to get going. So it's, you know, there's lots and lots of conversation. Then the other thing that I have found useful over the years is to send my prospective clients off on a garden tour. And they have a chance to go to 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 of my finished gardens of varying ages and sizes, and properties that kind of relate to what they may have, and it gives them a chance to see some finished work to just, you know, kind of spark their interest. And then we have more conversation and I get feedback. They often take pictures and they share places, like, you know, that really work for them or not. So it's the design process doesn't really get going immediately. There's a lot of conversation and really like feeling out the needs first. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, and it sounds like it's definitely a collaboration, and garden design or landscape design is not for those who aren't, let's just say, they're not people persons. So it's definitely about the relationship.
Yeah, it seems to me the folks who choose to work with me, they really care about their gardens, and they may or may not work in them themselves. They may very well have a landscape crew, or they might have a caretaker that takes, you know, does the actual work for them. But the folks that are attracted to my work seem to really have an affinity and a desire to really make their home more special and just a reflection of, you know, themselves and their personalities and how they want to entertain. And even if they're not like, you know, real super social types, it's just a matter of like making their own little cave feel perfect in their own way. You know, it's like we talk about taking a glass of wine or a cup of coffee and heading out the door into the garden. And a lot of my folks, that's, you know, they're here maybe just for the weekend, or maybe they're, you know, part-timers and it's like 4 or 5 days on the shore and the rest of the time at the, you know, back on the city side on your side or vice versa. But when they're here, the out of doors is really calling their name, and they, you know, they're like fully participating in their outdoor environment. And my clients have something to say. That's why, you know, I talk a lot, but I really do listen a lot too.
That is such an important skill to have. And I wanted to roll it back a little bit and ask about how you originally got into gardening and growing and garden design and art. So maybe talk a little bit about your childhood and how you came to become a landscape designer.
Oh boy. I do, when people ask me a question similar to that, that's a lot, you know. People have asked me similar questions, and I'll try to remember to answer everything. I made my first pot out of clay when I was 5. And I absolutely remember, you know, doing it and being in a little art class in the summer of my 5th year. And that, you know, kind of started me off with art, thinking that it was I wasn't thinking down the road that it was going to be, you know, my future work. I mean, who the heck knew at five? But I do remember really enjoying making a three-dimensional object. There's no question that was really fun. And then I just kept my hand in clay and in art of all sorts all the way through elementary school. I went to a friend's school in South Jersey where I lived and had a great art program and wonderful art teacher, and just, yeah, it was like that was one of my happiest classes as I was growing up. And I think the horticulture, I guess the horticulture happened naturally. I had a grandmother who was a great gardener, though I think she was like over it or didn't, you know, she was getting older by the time I realized that I liked horticulture. So we didn't overlap, but I think I probably inherited her genes. So the growing part came along later. When I lived in Florida, I recognized that there was something really cool about tropical plants growing in a garden. So that got me going on that score. And the art, you know, it's like the art and horticulture have been both present for forever. Like my entire life, I think I've always done some of both. The art was the major player in the beginning. Though, you know, Kathy, I hadn't thought about this in years, but when I was a little kid, I used to have a boyfriend, I mean, not like a boyfriend, I was too little, but a friend who happened to be a boy who lived next door. And I think I was only in about kindergarten, and I remember building a set of steps in the side of a ravine with this young guy, and thinking that that was like the coolest thing to do. We were, you know, using shovels and digging and making steps. And then I do remember when I was a little bit older, probably in, I don't know, fourth, fifth grade, building tree forts, again, with a male friend. I was friends with a lot of little boys. I was a bit of a tomboy. So it's like those early experiences put me outside. And I guess I liked the sense of accomplishment, like the feeling that I was actually making something. Does that answer? Wow. Does that answer? I mean, I hadn't thought about this in years. Good question. You got me thinking.
Well, I'm glad that brought back some good memories. That sounds like a wonderful childhood too.
Yeah, no, I was pretty lucky. But, yeah, my parents had a place that had about, I think it was like 12 acres of woods. And I spent a lot of time with poison ivy, unfortunately. But I also, you know, I remember being in the woods and, you know, taking walks with my dad and seeing skunk cabbage and thinking it was like super cool. And my mom grew lily of the valley up and down these stone steps that we had. And so, yeah, I wasn't like a super young horticulturalist by any means. It didn't happen until I was probably in my late teens or early 20s. But I think that there's certain memories that got me going as a kid. And I think just the pleasure of being out of doors. That's one of the joys of being a garden designer, that, you know, you can be outside a lot of the time. You don't have to be inside working at your desk. I do a lot of my drawings on site. It's very common for my clients to see me literally just plunked down sitting in the middle of their driveway with my mobile drawing board and sketching away. I think the little tomboy didn't really go away, even though I'm like not that young anymore.
It does sound like you kept a lot of that inside you. And when you're working and designing in the garden, do you ever work with clients who ask you, they might have an art piece or a sculpture on hand that they want to work into the landscape? And if they do, how do you work with that and orient it?
Yes, the answer is yes. It doesn't happen real frequently, but it does happen occasionally. And it's, you know, it's just a matter of, I guess it's like focusing on where and how do they want to see the piece. I'm really big on like seeing a piece of sculpture from the, you know, the main room of the house or from your kitchen table. You know, where do you spend most of your time? There's kind of that is a driver. Sometimes it's really fun to see a piece of art if you have a long driveway and you're headed home and we can use light in the garden. Particularly, it's really fun to have a piece of art that you see coming and going. There's, you know, that's really fun. I have at my own personal house, I have a bright red 36-inch long chili pepper at the end of my driveway. And it is lighted. And coming home at night in the wintertime, it's kind of fun to turn the corner into my driveway and see my chili pepper. So it's, you know, it depends on where you want, you know, how you want to view it. If you're sitting down at your patio at the pool, or if you're on your terrace and you have this like long view into the lawn, or even a short view if it's a teeny garden, you know, it's like, do you want to put the piece at sitting height to be viewed best from the table, or is it a piece that you're going to be walking by as you're, you know, headed from one garden room to the next? There are a lot of reasons. One of the coolest pieces, I don't even remember where it was, but I was on a garden tour with either the Garden Writers, now called GardenCom, or I was with a group from APLD, I can't remember, but we visited a home where there was a big, dark swimming pool, and there was this fabulous figurative piece of a kind of a chunky, overweight woman sitting right at the edge of the pool, and I thought that the juxtaposition to the water was just fabulous. So it's, you know, it's like whatever makes you tick. I have three habanero chili peppers that are sitting in a garden at one of my actually landscape client and art patron's house. It's like a joy for me when both, you know, both of my worlds align. These folks purchased three habanero peppers. They're three different colors, and they're set on their concrete bases at three different heights, oriented differently. But they see them when they're at their pool, they see them from the deck, and they're viewed from inside, from the kitchen, if you're at the workstation, you know, at the island, or if you're at the dining table, where they, you know, it's like, where do you spend that much time that, you know, and we arrange to have these three habanero peppers, like, you know, fill the need in a lot of different ways. It was, that was a super challenge and fun.
Yeah, those sound like really cool focal points for the garden as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, you asked me before about color. I think part of the driver for me to make my work like super colorful is because winter can be so quiet in the garden. You know, we're just like losing our beautiful fall leaves and we're left with evergreens. But we, you know, I kind of miss all those like hot colors that I use in perennials and flowering shrubs, and, you know, it's like all those plants go to sleep and we have a fairly, you know, gray, brown, green color scheme in the wintertime. So if my clients like love color, adding something like the habanero peppers or, you know, a big purple eggplant. I mean, you know, it's like you still have color and it gives the garden a just like another winter facet. It's, you know, it's sort of like that's when the sculpture really shines, because the plantings are they become secondary, and then it gives a chance for the sculpture to like step up to the plate and be the, you know, the lead character, and then maybe the sculpture takes a little bit of a, you know, a step back in the spring and summer when all the bulbs start blooming and all the flowers start coming out and all the flowering shrubs are doing their thing. So it's, yeah, it's like this symbiotic relationship. It's, it works. But those bright colors, I love seeing my, you know, I have a red chili pepper and I have a purple artichoke, and I have five asparagus of three different shades in my own personal garden. So as I'm coming down my driveway, it's like they're welcoming me all winter long. I just, you know, it's like there's still color in my garden, even if it's the dreariest February day. And that's why, because I've got, you know, I have like lime green, lavender, and trying to remember the other color asparagus that I have out there, but they're just, you know, they're like beacons. They're, you know, they're really cool.
That sounds like a wonderful view, and it kind of reminds me of those Corten steel Cotswold sheep that are at the Morris Arboretum as you enter up that hillside. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. Tell me about them.
So when you come to the Morris Arboretum outside of Philadelphia, you're kind of circling up a hillside, a very steep hillside, but you're going up it diagonally. And in the distance, there's these Corten steel cutouts of sheep, and they're a little bit bigger than life size. Yeah, they're like
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, in the big meadow. And, you know, depending on how the sunlight is coming at certain times of day, it can look like there's real sheep. until you drive by a little closer and you're like, no, that's a flat sheep.
Yeah, no, that sounds really cool. I saw that same effect. I wonder if it was the same artist. It was out in Napa, California, I think, at an art center there that they have, like sort of an artful sheep. And I can't remember if it was Corten or not, but it's a wonderful and whimsical look. I agree with you. It's, you know, dotting the hillside, especially. We don't have too many hillsides over here on the shore.
No.
But I love the imagery. I love that imagery. Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. Yep.
I'm looking it up. The artist is Charles Leyland, an American artist, and he is modern. So yeah, it could be the same one that you saw in California.
Yeah. Oh, that's very cool. Yeah. No, looking at sculpture in public places is, it's always inspirational. I still remember the feeling of being in Chicago and looking at that, what they call the bean, that giant reflective sculpture.
Yeah.
I just, you know, it's fabulous. And I remember seeing Henry Moore had an exhibit a number of years ago now at the New York Botanical Garden. And it's like there are works that I may forget specifically which work was where, but the it's just the feeling of walking through space and discovering a piece of art. There's just, you know, something really delightful about it. And it's just, there's that relationship between the plantings and a piece of sculpture that, you know, it's like you can't find that in the museum. It's different when you're out in the environment. Have you been to the Nasher? Is that out in Dallas? Is that a sculpture garden that you have visited?
No, I haven't been to that one. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, Dallas is Dallas, but the Nasher is, there's a modern art museum, and it's not a huge sculpture garden behind the museum, but I just remember feeling that it was so well done. I can't tell you who designed it, but the way you move through the space, and you just sort of have this natural progression through this landscaped area, some of it's very geometric, and other areas are softer corners. I remember there's a Henry Moore reclining nude right next to a like a rectangular shaped body of water, and if I remember correctly, there was a weeping willow not that far off, and the juxtaposition of the water and the sparkle and the willow leaves, and you know, and then this Moore sculpture, it was, you know, it's like I've got this little picture in my brain that I, you know, I saw this years ago, but it's still there. It's, I think it's all those elements, Kathy, that we get to use as garden designers, that are, that's what brings the garden alive, you know, and then sculpture is just one part of it. That's why it's so, I mean, for me, it's like when someone says, will you please, you know, sell me a piece of sculpture, and then I want you to site it in my garden, that's about as good a request as I get, you know, because I get to wear both hats. It's super fun.
Yeah, I just looked up the Nasher. So it's NASHER for those listeners, and it's in downtown Dallas. Next time I go to Dallas, I'll definitely have to visit there. It looks beautiful. And I would say my favorite sculpture garden outside of the greater DC area is the Walker in Minneapolis. Have you been to that one?
No, I've never been to Minneapolis. I'll put that on the list.
Oh, definitely go. If you go, it sits on the river, and it's part of the Walker Modern Art Museum, and the outdoor sculpture garden is immense, and you've probably seen the giant cherry on a spoon in a postcard. That's part of their garden. And, you know, you see that picture, iconic picture, all the time.
Absolutely.
But when you see it in person, it's huge. It's like laying down is probably like a 6-story building. And what I didn't realize is the cherry, the shiny cherry, actually has water flowing over it.
Oh, very cool.
So I was like, oh, that is not shown in the photos. You don't even think about that part of it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, Minneapolis is on my list. I will definitely get there. Thank you for the little boost.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city and a beautiful sculpture garden. Do you have any local D.C., Maryland, Virginia, or Pennsylvania, or Delaware sculpture gardens that you like to visit?
I think, you know, the PepsiCo isn't, that one's more, that's New York, that's Purchase, New York. I think that was one that I loved and remember visiting. It sounds sort of old fashioned, but I used to spend a lot of time as a high school kid over at the Rodin Museum in Philadelphia. And I'm, you know, it's not like my work is his or his, you know, I don't know that we can talk about my work in the same sentence, but I just remember being in that museum a lot. And it just, I guess by osmosis, it just sort of like filtered into my brain. That's like an old timey favorite. Washington is a city with tons of sculpture around. I love Chanticleer, even though it's not a sculpture garden. I think of the gardens that are up near, you know, Longwoods and Winterthur and that neck of the woods. I think Chanticleer is a favorite because they use gardens and plants in a whimsical way. And the structure is kind of interesting there. There's also a garden, it's not anywhere close. It was, it's the one that was near, I've been to Copenhagen, and there was a sculpture garden called, I think it's Louisiana. You can check me out on that one too. I visited many years ago, and I think, you know, as I think back at the places I've been and gardens that I've seen, that's one that strikes me as rather influential. I think that one also is like, if you get across the pond again, that would be a really good one to go see. It was a beautiful, just like a walking outdoor, beautiful space with tons of art. That's a good one. You know, and the other thing when I think about art and travel is I remember being in, I've been to Florence, I think, twice, and just like being in Florence, you don't even have to go to a museum. No, it's just like the whole city feels like an art museum to me. And I'm sure, one of the newest museums in the D.C. area is, Glenstone?
Yeah, Glenstone.
Yeah, Glenstone is, I've been there twice so far, and just really enjoyed the sculpture was, like, awesome, but the art is fabulous, and the way the architecture and the landscape and the art are all so integrated, you know, it's like you don't know where one starts and the other one stops. It's really beautifully done. I think everyone in the Washington area should go there one at a time, you know, carefully.
Yes. Yeah. Glenstone is definitely one of those immersive experiences.
Absolutely.
Where you're going to spend the better part of a day. You're not going to run through it in a half hour.
No, nor do you want to. Yeah. No, that's a real gift to the Washington area. There's no question. I thought that was like super special. And I've been twice, and when we start traveling again and doing things, we will do that. Once we move on to the next phase of our lives, we're things are getting better, maybe sooner, later. Who knows?
Hopefully, and by next summer, hopefully you can get out back to Glenstone.
Yep.
And for listeners, I was going to recommend, of course, on the National Mall, there's both the Hirshhorn Sculpture Garden and the National Gallery of Art Sculpture Garden, which have some amazing pieces. And then there's a little known sculpture garden that you can only visit. I guess they have their open house about once a year. And maybe you've been there too, Jan, which is the Ford Hook Farm, the headquarters of Burpee in Doylestown, PA. Have you been to that one?
No, I certainly have been to the sculpture garden at the Hirshhorn about 100 times. So
yeah,
I agree with you on our local sculpture gardens. They're fabulous, but no, I haven't been to the Burpee one. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, they open up once or twice a year for a weekend to come and look at their trial plants.
Uh-huh.
Usually it's toward the end of July, early August.
Yep.
And then you're encouraged to go and look at the trial gardens. And then you're like, wait a minute, over here is an incredible sculpture collection.
Wow.
And beautiful landscape of just like rolling meadows and different annual flower combinations. That was a joy to find. So
look up
Ford Hook Farm and get on Burpee's mail list, because they send that postcard or email with that invitation about once a year. And hopefully, of course, post COVID, they'll open it back up again for that.
Yeah. You know, I did know of that because it might have been this either last summer or this summer that I had conversation with someone at Burpee, and I thought about going, because I now that you describe it, I know what you're talking about. But I was going to go more as a landscape person, not so much a sculptor. I didn't even realize I was going to go look at the trial gardens. Oh, that's so wonderful. What a little secret that you've just shared with the world.
Yeah, it's definitely something to stumble across and be like, okay, now this is a nice bonus. And I could totally see one of your sculptures in that landscape as well, Jan.
Oh, good. Thank you. Well, put in a good word for me. Oh, you know, the other garden that we haven't, I don't know what you think of it, Grounds for Sculpture up in up near Trenton, New Jersey. Do you know that place?
I do, but it's been so long since I've been there.
Yeah, it's most unusual. And I guess the sense is sometimes I feel like it's like so much work and so many diverse pieces, and it's like sensory overload. But it is if you're like on your way to New York or on your way home from New York and you want a little side trip, that's that can be a fun one too. That's, you know, if you're looking, if you're really into sculpture, that's a fun one. And they have some really cool exhibits. Yeah. No, we could just spend our lives like bouncing around from sculpture garden to sculpture garden.
And that wouldn't be a bad thing.
No, I'm thinking, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
I think you and I need to plan a road trip.
Definitely. We'll just make a compass point to compass point.
You got it. That sounds like that.
So for our listeners, how can they view your online portfolio of both your sculptures and landscape work?
Easiest way is to just go to jankirschstudio.com, and that's K-I-R-S-H .com, jankirschstudio.com. And I have a little store online now as well. So yeah, we're easily found. If you just Google my name, something's bound to pop up.
And I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. And I always want to spell your name with a C in it, like the German word for cherry.
Yes.
But
don't go there.
Don't go there. I'm sure that happens a lot, but it's, yeah. So for listeners, it's Jan, just like it sounds, and then K-I-R-S-H.
Thanks, Kath.
Well, thank you so much for talking about your art, your design, and your life with us today.
It was this was like a really fun and totally unexpected pleasure. I I didn't know that I had that much to say, but I guess I do. Thank you for asking. And then, Kathy, your questions were really first class. Got me thinking. So good work on your part, my dear. That was excellent. Really had some fun.
Well, thank you, Jan, and welcome to the podcast world.
Thank you.
Plant profile, rosemary. Rosemary is a woody perennial or subshrub. Rosemary's Latin name has been recently changed to reflect the fact that it is actually part of the sage or salvia family. It comes in many forms, from prostrate to vertical, and in foliage shades that range from blue-green to golden-yellow. Rosemary Arp is a reliably hardy variety for the Mid-Atlantic region. It can withstand our freeze-thaw-freeze winter cycles, which can often be the demise of other rosemary varieties. The key is good drainage and full sun. Don't overwater it, as it is susceptible to root rot. An ideal situation is to plant it overhanging a rock wall. Be sure to give it room, as it can spread to 4 feet wide and high. Rosemary is drought-tolerant and deer-proof. Pollinators love it. Honeybees are especially attracted to the tiny blue or white flowers. There is usually no need to fertilize it, though a little fish fertilizer occasionally will not hurt. To start new plants, it is best to take cuttings, as it is difficult to grow rosemary from seed. When using it in cooking, snip off young stems and leaves for the freshest taste. You can take up to a third of the plant at any one time, then let it recover before harvesting from it again. At holiday time, you will see potted up rosemary plants sold in grocery stores. These are often quite root-bound and will not live long in indoor conditions. Take cuttings liberally and use them for cooking and decoration, then discard the plant when it starts to decline. Try growing rosemary in your garden today. You can grow that. For this week's What's Blooming in the Garden segment, I wanted to focus on indoor blooms. Now is the time of year that days are getting short and we're turning to some bright colors for our holiday plants. And I have an upcoming webinar on that very topic, and also indoor bulb forcing. If you're interested in that, go to our website, washingtongardener.com or washingtongardener.blogspot.com. And in the keyword search, enter webinar or webinars, and you should see the last couple webinars that we're offering this year. And the one on holiday plants and indoor bulb forcing demonstration is taking place December 6th at 2 p.m. That's a Sunday, And if you can't make it live to listen to the session, you can still register for it and then be sent the recording afterwards. So in my indoor plant world, I have a bunch of violets, a little violet collection on my bedroom windowsill, which is thankfully a very deep windowsill. I'm very thankful in this old house that I have windows that are about 18 inches or more wide. So it gives me plenty of plant demonstration and homes for them, of course, and also the cats' napping spots. And nearby that, I have some purple foliage plants and also my Thanksgiving cactus. And yes, that is Thanksgiving cactus, not Christmas cactus. That's being sold in most stores these days. And if you see it in bloom now, it is that Thanksgiving cactus. And in that talk that I have coming up, that webinar, I'll talk about some more of the differences between the different kinds of Thanksgiving, Christmas, and even Easter cactus. But mine is blooming up its storm. It's kind of a fuchsia lipstick pink. It should go on for a few more weeks, and then it usually drops its blooms, and then it has a little bit of a sporadic rebloom next spring, summer. The other thing I'm looking forward to is the box full of amaryllis that I have put into dormancy in my attic. I've cut back the foliage, I've stopped watering them, and I'll pull them out in about a month or so to get them started on their new process. And then the last thing I'm enjoying indoors are a couple of orchids I've gifted to myself to get me through this winter blah short day period. And I recommend you do the same. Doesn't have to be orchids, could be anything indoor blooming, maybe just a fresh bouquet of flowers, maybe some cuttings from your own garden, maybe some paper whites you force into bloom. You know, treat yourself in these gray, brown, early winter, late fall days, and have a wonderful holiday season. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter by going to anchor.fm/Kathy-Gents/support. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can become a listener supporter, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Another way to support Garden DC is to go to WashingtonGardener.com and subscribe to Washington Gardener Magazine. You can find Washington Gardener online at WashingtonGardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.